The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
With these staffing trends, you can also see staff increases in the leadership offices in Congress. And so the picture you get is a kind of an overall decline in resources, I would say, but a shifting of resources away from what you might think of as sort of substance toward politics within the institution of Congress. And the agencies are really illustrative of that. So, you know, when you think about congressional expertise, well, where do they get their expertise on certain subject areas? Well, they get them from committee staff and from the in-house congressional agencies, agencies like the Government Accountability Office, the Congressional Research Service, and the Office of Technology Assessment. The latter doesn't exist anymore. Now, so you see over time, all of those agencies have declined. OTA was zeroed out in 96. It still exists in statute. It was just defunded. And what's interesting about OTA is that its express purpose was supplying Congress with its own independent source of science and technology expertise. So precisely the kind of expertise that would be relevant, for example, in thinking about how we should regulate laboratory diagnostic tests.
I'm Margaret Taylor, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, May 8th, 2020. I sat down with Tony Mills, Director of Science Policy at the R Street Institute, to talk about an article he recently wrote with Robert Cook Deegan titled, "Where's Congress? Don't Just Blame Trump for the Coronavirus Catastrophe." We talked about the limited role of Congress in responding to the current crisis and, more broadly, its diminished institutional capacity to absorb and respond to developments in science, technology, and medicine. It's the Lawfare Podcast, Tony Mills on Congress's institutional limitations in responding to the coronavirus. So, Tony, first I want to talk about the sort of immediate premise of your very good article that caught my eye, and it's titled, "Where's Congress? Don't Just Blame Trump for the Coronavirus Catastrophe." And it was striking because you're right. It seems that, you know, as this country has been grappling with this global pandemic, it seems like all of the focus about what went wrong, you know, in the weeks and months that have passed, it's all focused on President Trump, administration officials like Alex Azar, Robert Redfield, who's the head of the CDC, Tony Fauci, and executive branch more generally, like the intelligence community. It seems like Congress is an afterthought. Why do we think of Congress as an afterthought when one of these crises hits?
Yeah, well, let me just say thank you for the compliments on the article. I appreciate that, and grateful for the opportunity to talk about this. You know, it's a great question. I mean, I think there are a few different ways to look at it. The first is to say, you know, it's a natural thing. I mean, it's obviously natural to look at the president during any kind of crisis, and for better or for worse, that tends to be where we focus our attention, especially nowadays. But I think more substantively, you know, during a crisis, for example, like a public health emergency like this, there's a very natural reason to do that, to look at the executive branch, because executive agencies in particular are charged with essentially being the first line of defense. They have a lot of discretion in how they act and what they choose to do. They sort of set the policy for the crisis response. So in a certain sense, that's as it should be. And we're not saying in the article necessarily that that shouldn't be the case, that there's no role for the FDA or the CDC or NIH, et cetera. But I think a more subtle point that you're getting at is, you know, what kinds of expectations do we have built into how we think about government's operations? And I think the fact that Congress is not top of mind at all, that it's really is just an afterthought, is very telling. I think it's symptomatic of an institutional reality that Congress does tend to take a back seat, especially in science, technology, and medicine-related policy. And so what we're trying to do in this article is question that institutional arrangement. And I think, you know, there's the issue of how things operate under normal circumstances and then how things operate during an emergency. And those are not the same, but those underlying dynamics are there in both cases. And that's really what we're trying to tease out, is what should Congress's role be? And our hypothesis is that maybe Congress should be playing a more active role, not just in the actual response to a crisis, but in the day-to-day operations of science, technology, and medicine policy. And maybe if that were true, we wouldn't have seen a response as shoddy as the one we've seen, especially in the first few weeks or months.
Yeah, and I guess we should clarify, you know, obviously Congress has played a very big role in the response, meaning the appropriating money, you know, three huge bills, trillions of dollars being appropriated by Congress to the executive branch for, you know, vaccine development, for the sort of economic side of this catastrophe, support to individuals. So it's not that Congress has done nothing. What you're really focused on is, you know, what role could Congress have played, or should they have played, sort of in the longer lead up to a crisis like this. But before we get to that sort of more longer term lead up, I want to just, because I did go back and look, because your article got me asking myself, okay, what exactly did Congress do in the early months of this? And, you know, I was going back, and as early as, I think it's like late January, mid to late January, the Senate Health Committee and the Senate Foreign Relations Committee hosted a briefing for senators with top administration health officials. So that was Chairman Lamar Alexander on the coronavirus. And so it seems like Congress was searching for information from the administration. A few days later, you know, you probably saw that Senator Chris Murphy tweeted, you know, just left the administration briefing on coronavirus. Bottom line, they aren't taking this seriously enough. Notably, no requests for any emergency funding, which is a big mistake. Local health systems need supplies, training, screening staff, et cetera, and they need it now. So I was just sort of thinking about, you know, it seems like late January, early February, there were people on Congress who sort of knew what was going on. They sort of got it. It seems like there wasn't an ability to sort of raise enough noise about what these particular people sort of saw about what was going on. What do you make of that?
Yeah, no, you make a number of great points. So absolutely true that Congress, it's not as if Congress has done nothing, and it certainly don't want to suggest that. By looking at the lack of congressional involvement, what we're really thinking about in this article is the crisis response. So for example, the decision about who to grant emergency authorization to begin to develop tests and to deploy the tests, and how those are deployed, what kinds of laboratories to allow in that process or not. You know, just to name one particularly significant example. You know, obviously Congress isn't playing a particularly active role there, and that may seem sort of silly, right? Like, why would Congress be involved in that? But Congress is involved, for example, in writing the legislation that determines how those agencies operate in this space. And they have tended to give, for example, the FDA a fair amount of discretion about how it should implement emergency protocols in circumstances like this. And also to your point, that is not entirely lost on Congress. There's some activity right now around the VALID Act, which would, it does a number of things, but one of the things that that bill would do is reform the regulatory environment around diagnostic testing. So, you know, I don't want to suggest that nobody on the Hill is thinking about these questions. You point to another set of good examples there, too. I think the broader point is the one you raise, right? Why does it not seem to make much difference? And I think to really to get at that question, we have to look at some of the nitty-gritty of the things we're talking about. So what is the regulatory regime for diagnostic testing? You know, why was the CDC essentially monopolizing the testing process for the first month of the government's response? So those are the kinds of questions that we have in mind there. And I think to really suss that out, I mean, you could look at it a few different ways. There is, what has Congress done or not done to create the institutional environment that we had when the crisis hit? But there's also the question, does Congress have the capacity it needs to suss out what went wrong ex post facto? And then the third thing is, thinking medium or longer term, what can Congress do to try to prevent something like this from happening again?
And so you talk in the article about these various institutions that are or have traditionally been are part of the congressional branch of government. So, for example, the Government Accountability Office, the OTA. Talk a little bit about those institutions, how you have seen them change over the years, and what you think would be sort of the right institutional mix for Congress going forward.
Sure. Yeah. So part of the argument is that this is a kind of broader institutional failing or weakness. And what it really comes down to is a lack of expert capacity in Congress. So a kind of lack of expertise within the legislature. Now, as you point out, it's not as though there's no expertise in Congress. It's not as though they can't hold hearings and commission GAO or the National Academies of Sciences to study things. But I think that if you look over time, you can see a trajectory, especially in Congress, that has essentially resulted in a declining role for expertise in Congress. And this becomes a kind of self-fulfilling. And I'll talk a little bit about the specifics in just one second, the agencies you mentioned and so forth. But I just want to say that I think this becomes a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy whereby Congress, because it lacks this expert capacity, we don't really expect much of Congress in this respect because they don't necessarily have the capacity. So they may be overly deferential to executive agencies, for example, or reliant on outside groups for this kinds of expertise. And that's really the kind of institutional pathology that we're talking about in the article. Now, as for the actual declining expertise, there are different ways that you can track that. You know, political scientists have different proxies or metrics for that. I think a really easy way to look at it is, first of all, staff in Congress, and then specifically the congressional agencies. And so you can see overall declines in congressional staff, but specifically declines in congressional committees and declines in the staff of congressional agencies over time. And this goes back decades. This is not something brand new. It certainly became worse in the 90s. Let me just add a kind of wrinkle to that, which is that with these staffing trends, you can also see staff increases in the leadership offices in Congress. And so the picture you get is a kind of an overall decline in resources, I would say, but a shifting of resources away from what you might think of as sort of substance toward politics within the institution of Congress. And the agencies are really illustrative of that. So, when you think about congressional expertise, well, where do they get their expertise on certain subject areas? Well, they get them from committee staff and from the in-house congressional agencies like the Government Accountability Office, the Congressional Research Service, and the Office of Technology Assessment. The latter doesn't exist anymore. Now, so you see over time, all of those agencies have declined. OTA was zeroed out in 96. It still exists in statute. It was just defunded. And what's interesting about OTA is that its express purpose was supplying Congress with its own independent source of science and technology expertise. So precisely the kind of expertise that would be relevant, for example, in thinking about how we should regulate laboratory diagnostic tests.
And so why would that be? Why is it, Congress has the purse strings. Congress can appropriate funding for itself. It could give itself more money for committee staff, for a new OTA-like entity, more staff for GAO. What changed? Why doesn't Congress appropriate more for itself to be able to do its job better? What's your sort of diagnosis of why that trajectory has happened that way?
Yeah, I mean, it's a big question. I think there are a number of ways to look at it. I would maybe suggest two ways to look at it. One would be the kind of political history. I think you can't ignore the politics of the 1990s and thinking about the story, especially with OTA. And so the kind of rough and ready version of that is, you know, you had the Gingrich Revolution, a new Republican majority in Congress, and part of their charge, as they understood it, was to shrink government, sort of classic conservative idea. And part of the goal there was to sort of start the cuts at home so that it wasn't just, you know, hey, we're cutting this part of the federal government while we're still, you know, fat and happy over here in Congress. They wanted to look close to home first to make cuts. OTA was kind of an obvious, easy target in that environment, partly because of, I mean, it, as a matter of the budget, it was not very significant, but OTA had developed some, had become unpopular in certain circles among Republicans. I would say overall, I think it was actually very well respected, even across party lines, but there were some public episodes that kind of did not endear OTA to Republicans. There was a notorious issue with the Star Wars project in the 1980s that soured a lot of Republicans on OTA, for example. And it was also seen to be duplicative. This argument, justification for getting rid of OTA, is actually very prevalent in the debates of the era. The idea was, look, there's a lot of expertise around here. Why do we need this particular entity to do this? The kinds of arguments that I and a lot of my colleagues make about separation of powers, for example, why Congress might not want to be dependent on the executive branch, those kinds of arguments weren't really part of the mix then, just sort of an interesting artifact of the political landscape at the time.
Yeah, and you know, just to foot stomp on that point a little bit, I was listening to the oral arguments that the D.C. Circuit sitting en banc heard regarding a couple of cases, one of which was the question of Don McGahn needing to come up and testify on the Mueller report. And the Department of Justice essentially, at one point, the lawyer for the Department of Justice said to the judges, you know, there is no right of Congress to get information from the executive branch. You just sort of said it. And it really struck home for me, that very thing that you're talking about, which is, you know, in the context of separation of powers, if the position of the executive branch is Congress has no right to basically any information from the executive branch, then what is Congress to do? It just struck me as quite sort of surprising, actually, to be said out loud.
Yeah, it's pretty stark characterization of the situation. Yeah, I mean, this gets to this is sort of the second answer I would hazard to the question of why this happened. I mean, so there's the kind of more recent kind of political explanation, which it definitely plays a role, and we could talk about that more. I happen to think it was a Pyrrhic victory for Republicans to have kind of weakened Congress. And then, you know, several years, decades later, a lot of conservatives are worried now about, not all, but some are worried about the relative weakening of Congress. And they probably should look at their own political history for part of the explanation for that. But the broader issue is you can see this trend going back, I mean, really to World War II, which is when the executive branch became, well, really when the federal government became heavily interested in scientific and technological research, and the executive branch tended to take the lead there. And after the war, beginning really in the late 50s, early 60s, you started to see Congress worried. There was a sort of general worry about, hey, maybe we should be more actively involved in legislating, but really in the realm of science and technology, because of the massive projects that the executive branch, the DOD, were undertaking, and Congress was being asked to sign checks for this stuff, and they realized they didn't really have the expertise to evaluate it. And these debates culminated in 1972 with the Technology Assessment Act, which created the OTA. But it was part of a broader legislative reform in that era, where you saw the renaming and strengthening of CRS and other changes. And there, what's really interesting and crystal clear about those debates is the problem that you're raising, that Congress saw this first and foremost as an institutional one. They were very worried about the dependence on the executive. So there are really two issues there. There's access to information, and then there's the reliability of the information. The worry was not only that they didn't have the expertise, but that if they were dependent on the agencies they were supposed to be overseeing, there's a kind of conflict of interest there. And you could look to outside groups, but then you are dependent on other stakeholders in that process. So the idea behind OTA, for example, was to build an independent source of that expertise. Really good example of this. Think about laboratory diagnostics today. It looks like some kind of reform is going to happen in that space. And that's probably a good thing, given the kind of central role that diagnostics played in the government's response.
And there you're talking about the sort of government labs or the private labs that were relied upon to sort of develop and implement a bunch of this testing.
Right. So these are non-governmental labs. So for example, you know, university laboratories or hospitals, which they occupy a sort of strange space in the regulatory regime because they're not, this is a matter of dispute, but a lot of laboratory diagnostics are not regulated by the FDA. They're considered the practice of medicine, whereas commercial medical devices are. That whole regime changed when the emergency declaration kicked on, and then you had a new regulatory regime, which effectively required everybody to get permission from the FDA. And this, the issue over how to regulate diagnostics goes back decades. I mean, it goes back to the, you know, decades and decades and decades. But it's now front and center, as it should be. But if you look at what's going on in Congress, you know, who's playing an active role in the writing of the legislation for this? Well, the FDA, because that's where you would turn to get expertise if you're Congress. But relying on agencies that may have made serious mistakes, I mean, I think we're going to know a lot more. I don't want to prejudge anything here. We'll know a lot more in the months to come. But it certainly looks like the FDA made some mistakes in this response. Do we want to be entirely dependent on the FDA for our information about how to regulate in this space? It might not be the best arrangement, right? And there are a lot of examples of that. So that was part of the motivation for creating something like OTA back in the day.
And so thinking about, you know, what are the types of challenges that Congress should be more expert on in the technology field. You know, I have an interest and I've podcasted and written about, for example, 5G. And you know, I think artificial intelligence falls into this field as well. I mean, it seems to me there's so many technological issues that will define the new digital economy, that will sort of reshape how we think about civil liberties. Mm-hmm. And yet there isn't really, as far as I can see, you know, CRS does a bunch, but there isn't the type of sort of technologically focused entity within Congress to provide expertise on that. And in the case of something like 5G and artificial intelligence, it seems like largely a lot of that information expertise resides in the private sector. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, of course, Congress can do hearings and hear from the private sector, but it's not even a matter of calling on other government experts within the executive branch and hearing from them. It's sort of like, you know, you're calling upon the private sector to provide expertise and guidance. That seems pretty difficult to do, and seems like Congress tying its hands a bit. Do you see the challenges like 5G and artificial intelligence like in the same light, or should they be handled in a different way?
No, absolutely. And I think there are a lot of other examples and even issues that aren't maybe overtly scientific. I mean, most really large scale political problems have some technical component of some kind. And so I think you're absolutely right. And one, I think, important qualification is that, you know, it's not the case that Congress has no expertise. You point to CRS. Another thing to highlight here is GAO, which after OTA shuttered, took over some of OTA's duties and has recently secured more funding to build that program out. And so they are supplying some of that. But I think, and I hope that they are able to do more and more. That would be one step in the right direction. But I think the broader issue here is that it's not simply a matter of having in your hands the, you know, expert information. it's the kind of information that you need to have access to. So, you know, if you're thinking about, it's just a regulatory issue, you know, how should X be regulated and by what agency? It seems like it would be a pretty good idea to have the input of more than just the regulated entity and the agency that would be regulating them, you know, to be very simplistic about it. But even beyond that, most of the issues that you mentioned, right? So artificial intelligence or cybersecurity, environmental issues, they tend to implicate a very wide range of things, right? It's not just a purely technical question. It bears on civil liberties. It bears on maybe the social impacts of a new technology or how it impacts this part of the private sector. And so it seems to me that what you would want is to have, you do want to have the private sector's input and the executive branch's input. You want to have the whole range of stakeholders at the table. But you need to be able to have a kind of deliberation that has all of those inputs, but is also responsive to democratic pressures and to, you know, the opinions of scientists and the academy and so on. So it's a multifaceted kind of approach. And these big technical issues seem like precisely the kinds of problems that call for that kind of approach.
Getting back to your point about leadership wanting to sort of garner resources, leadership in Congress wanting to garner the resources like for itself. Have you seen that play out? Why do you think it's happening? Any, you know, prospects in your mind for changing that dynamic, delegating more power sort of back down to committee chairs?
Yeah, I mean, it's also a long-term, I see that as a kind of long-term trend that complements, not favorably, the technical issues that we were talking about. And there are a lot of facets to it. I think one way to look at it is having long deliberative approaches to policy where, you know, you might not get everything you want. I mean, there are a lot of obvious reasons why somebody might not want to engage in that kind of work, right? Leadership has an eye on political success, looking at, you know, kind of keeping controversial issues off the table for the sake of elections or whatever. There are kind of familiar political dynamics that might partly explain that. You know, why has that got worse over time? I mean, I'm not sure I have a simple answer to that. I think the declining role of committees over time, which again goes back decades, is certainly a part of that story. In terms of whether there are kind of positive indicators, I think there are. I mean, there's a bipartisan focus on this issue, at least among certain folks here in DC. There's a kind of growing awareness that this is a problem. Recent interest in bringing back earmarks, for example. There are a lot of different issues that I think I'll speak to the same problem, which is that Congress doesn't seem to be working very well. So that's hopeful by itself. And there are certain, you know, members or offices where they're more receptive to these reform-minded ideas. That said, I mean, I don't want to be naive about, you know, I think even if Congress were able, and this would be, it's a tough sell, to bring back OTA or create a new OTA-like entity, I don't think that's going to solve the problem by itself. I mean, these are broad institutional issues that are going to require lots of hard work over a long period of time.
You talk in the article about, you know, strengthening the links between expertise and governance, you know, that Congress itself has weakened in the past decades. As I read our current political environment, there seems to be, at least I see it as coming from a bit from the Trump administration, sort of a disdain for expertise. And this may be a moment when the value of expertise and the value of good governance makes a comeback in the wake of this sort of pandemic. I mean, do you see that as a possibility in terms of the way we sort of think about expertise and the link between expertise and governance?
Yeah, I think it's possible. I think it will depend on sort of how it happens. You know, one of the sort of subsidiary arguments of the piece is that, you know, we tend to think, I think that there is a reflexive view of expertise as taking the place of democratic deliberation. You know, you just sort of give the experts the power to make some decisions and things will all work out really well. One of the arguments we're making here is that centralization in government actually seems to be leading to a decrease in expertise informing our governing institutions. So it may be a little bit counterintuitive, but that's part of the argument. So I think related to that, I think that there, yes, you know, expertise is obviously crucially important. And the argument that we're making here, in my view generally, is that, you know, we need Congress to have more and better expertise and other branches of government too. But what's, I think, really interesting about Congress in this context is that it's the Constitution's first branch. It's the most democratic branch of government. And so the idea isn't just to kind of give expertise, you know, all the political power or something like that. It's to try to think about how best to integrate expertise into our democratic governing institutions. And, you know, my sense is that doing that well will actually yield better, you know, technically better policy, or at least it can, in addition to, you know, good politics.
So circling back to what Congress is doing now on pandemic response, I'm sure you saw that House Democrats set up a special subcommittee to specifically perform like oversight and investigate the Trump administration's spending of these trillions of dollars and, you know, sort of investigate the pandemic response itself. Do you see, like, what's your view of that committee? Do you see that as sort of a good thing that's coming about, that that can really focus and answer some of these questions? Or do you see it as kind of another example of this concentrating the oversight function or the expertise into one place rather than having it be in a bunch of places?
I mean, having it anywhere is probably, you know, a good thing. I think the worry is, you know, going back to the origins of OTA, that era, the, you know, debate about legislative reform and everything, what's interesting and sort of attractive about that, the debates that were going on then, is that people were thinking institutionally. So the idea was that there is a natural kind of adversarial relationship between the legislature and the executive. And you know, I think you mentioned the DC Circuit example as the line about, you know, no, the Congress has no right to get information from the executive. That's an example of that kind of adversarial relationship. And I think that's good and healthy. It's part of the constitutional system that we have. I think the danger is that it can become confused with just political kind of partisanship. And that obviously happens in a situation where, you know, Congress is controlled by one, or one chamber is controlled by one party and the president by another and so on. And so what I hope is that if we have a lot of congressional investigation into what has happened, you know, here since January, that is driven more by kind of the institutional dynamics and expertise and not just by partisanship, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I think it does. I mean, I guess the one way I think about it is, you know, will this committee or, you know, the oversight in general be more like, you know, the 9/11 commission, or will it be more like sort of the Benghazi
right
inquiry? And to me, that it seems like that's kind of the critical question. Is there enough bipartisan support and recognition of the importance of, you know, performing oversight and figuring out what went wrong, why the country finds itself in the position it finds itself in, which is, you know, how the 9/11 Commission conducted itself? Or is it more of, you know, kind of being viewed as like a political bludgeon?
Right, right, exactly. And so I think this gets to the congressional expertise issue again, right? Because I think part of the worry is that if there is insufficient expertise, things are kind of naturally going to get politicized. That's kind of that's sort of the implication of our article, right? Is that you have this centralizing of political power in Congress and a decline of expertise. So I hope that we can have something more like what you're describing, that, you know, the 9/11 Commission, but that will depend on Congress having the relevant expertise. Right. I mean, to know what kinds of questions to ask and how to evaluate them and to think seriously about making reforms on the basis of that is going to require, you know, to go back to the issue of laboratory diagnostics. I mean, that's a technical issue. All kinds of complex problems involved there. And so it will require that Congress have that expertise to evaluate that kind of problem. So I hope that they are able to do that. But I do have some inherent skepticism given the overall institutional trends we've been talking about.
So I have to just, you know, say it out loud. There were definitely instances. I worked on Capitol Hill for almost six years. There were times when I sort of witnessed situations where the technical expertise actually was there on a particular topic. It was provided to a member. A member said, you know what? I get it. I understand that there's, you know, a technical issue here, but my politics, you know, what I need to do politically is something else right now. And so I just really, I can't sort of go with the expert view on it. I mean, it seems to me that's like, that is going to happen. It's sort of based on what the personality is of the members of Congress. So, I mean, I guess my question is, to what extent do you see this all as sort of contingent on the individual decisions that members decide to make about how they're going to use expert information?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think this is why I say I certainly would not want to suggest that having more expertise, even in-house expertise in Congress, is going to solve all the problems. I think that's certainly not the case. There are two things I would say about that. One is there's an issue that a lot of folks in this space are worried about. It's sort of the absorption problem, which is that, you know, even if you have expertise, is it really being absorbed into the legislative process? Are members of Congress really relying on it? Do they know what the resources are, and if they can access them, you know, how is it really informing lawmaking? And that's a real issue. And I don't think it's one that can just be solved by standing up a new agency or something like that. But I would say that I'm kind of allergic to the idea that, you know, there's an inherent opposition to, you know, technical expertise and the political process. So any technical issue, you know, a lawmaker is going to have to be weighing a whole set of issues, some of them technical, some of them not, you know, value judgments. They're, you know, representing the interests of their constituents. And so I would kind of resist thinking about it as, you know, expertise versus representative politics. I think the goal is to try to have the two integrated as much as possible. And you're never going to have, it's not going to yield perfect outcomes all the time by any means. So I don't want to suggest that, but I do think we could do better than we're doing now.
Tony, thank you so much for coming on the Lawfare Podcast. Any final thoughts before we exit?
No, I just, thanks a lot for the opportunity to come on and talk about this. I'm grateful.
Well, I hope some of your ideas get picked up and move forward in the Congress in the opportunities to come, perhaps in the wake of this pandemic. So thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. If you haven't yet, please take a second to share the Lawfare Podcast on social media and give us a 5-star rating and review wherever you found us. You can also now purchase Lawfare swag at our online store, www.thelawfarestore.com. The podcast is edited by Jen Patya Howell, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
A little something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional, unprofessional. So if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.